91.3 KXCI Tucson. Real people, real radio.
Hello, and welcome to our friends and listeners today. Thank you for joining us at KXCI 91.3. This is Aspen Green with my co-host Kathy Harris, and we're bringing you Broad Perspectives Radio, a program by women, about women, but for everyone. And you can hear more of our shows at kxci.org on many topics on our Broad Perspectives podcast page on the KXCI website. Today, we have an important story to share. Dora Rodriguez shares her story of survival, resilience, and hope from her journey through the Sonoran Desert to decades of advocacy in Tucson. And I'm so thrilled to have Dora with us here today, Kathy.
I am too, and Dora has such an amazing story. Let's just start with back in 1980, Dora was 19 years old, and she left El Salvador in the midst of civil war there in search of safety from the political violence that was threatening her life. She crossed the border through Organ Pipe Cactus National Monument with 26 people. 13 of those people died, but she was one of the 13 survivors, but she was found near death. By publicizing her migration story and through her support for migrants' rights since her crossing, Dora's survival story propelled the sanctuary movement in Tucson. Through public speaking and advocacy work, Dora's focus is to educate communities about the harsh realities migrants face in the desert and to inspire changes to the immigration injustices plaguing our border towns. She now resides in Tucson with her husband and 5 children. Dora is also a proud grandmother. She serves as the founder and director of Selva Vision, a nonprofit offering aid and support to migrants and deportees. Her memoir, Dora, A Daughter of Unforgiving Terrain, has just been released. In it, she describes her life in El Salvador, experiences crossing the border, and her subsequent advocacy work. Dora, we're so happy to have you here. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. It's my honor.
It's definitely our honor, and we're so happy to have you here today to talk about your escape from El Salvador to the U.S. Now, that's been 45 years ago. What was your life like in El Salvador before coming to the U.S. at age 19? And what circumstances led you to risk your life to come here?
So my life in El Salvador was beautiful. I was contained with what I had, a daughter of a single woman, because my father was an alcoholic, so he was not present much in our life. But my mother raised us with good morals, with very strong Catholics, going to church every Sunday, 2-3 times a day. Those beautiful values that you have as a child, even if the money was not there. So money was not really for us, or material things important. What it was for us was the community, the family, our values. It was beautiful. I was a happy kid until I got to be 18 when things started changing in our country. And I was old enough and involved in so many youth groups that would lead my life to be in danger because our country was changing in the fact that the government was now pretty much in a war with the civil community. It was after young people like myself. So that really changed because now I found myself as a 19-year-old making a decision to leave what I knew, to leave what I loved behind, to leave my mother and my siblings. And I think it has been the most painful decision I have ever made in my life.
Can you describe for us in your book, you talk about the military conservative government was actually killing people. Why were you and other people considered such a threat to the government, but they would actually kill you?
Because we in our country at that time, we were being silenced, in other words. We could not express our feelings, our fears. I was very involved with the Marino Sisters that were later murdered in a youth group in my church. I was also involved with my high school sweetheart and the teachers union. So I was very busy And for us was normal prior to the government targeting young people who were organized. It was a fun thing to do. I also belonged to the Cub Scouts. I was the leader of the Cub Scouts. But that was normal for us to do. It was good to be involved so you wouldn't not get involved with drugs or doing the wrong things. My actions of community activists at that age in my town were seen differently by our government.
Well, I was struck by your words at the beginning of your book. You said, "I had no idea what I was getting myself into when I left my country. I only knew if I stayed, I would be killed." And you actually had friends who were killed, and you mentioned the Marinol sisters were actually killed by the military government. It sounds like you had solid reasons to believe that you would be killed. So tell us, how did you go about leaving your country at age 19 and coming to the US? It took you more than one attempt to get here, right?
Right. Yeah, it took me three times. The first time that I had to make the decision, I came with a group of friends. And yes, I didn't have no idea because I was very sheltered in my country. Like I mentioned in my book, we at that time there were no cell phones, there were no computers. We never had a television until I was 16. So we didn't know pretty much the outside world. Didn't know what I was expecting, but I knew that I was in danger. And then we get apprehended, and then I go back home. And then the next time was guided by three smugglers from El Salvador who were offering safe trips to the United States, like travel agency. They were smugglers. I did not know about that. I was so naive. I didn't know that existed, that people get paid to travel people to the United States with no documents. That second trip, we paid $2,500 that my family in Los Angeles helped my mother to get. And they offered two times. They said, if you get caught once, we'll bring you back. Before we left El Salvador the second time, that's when Bishop Romero was murdered. And my fears were indescribable because if they kill him, they could kill anyone. So the government ordered the murder of Bishop Romero. Bishop Romero was the priest, the cardinal of El Salvador, who had helped to organize the marginalized communities to really fight for their rights, to ask the government, how can we have a better life? And all they were fighting was for the land, for equality, because they've been exploited for so many years. Our country is well known to have 14 families that owned it, pretty much the country in the farming industry with coffee and sugarcane. And so it was very controlled by them. So when Bishop Romero started organizing through his teaching with communities, the government targeted him. And the one of the said stories to know and remember is that man who shot him while he was saying mass and lifting up his communion in that moment, it was so well planned that one bullet crossed his heart. And those two soldiers that were ordered to kill him were trained in the United States.
Wow. So you tried twice to cross the border and were brought back both times, and then you tried a third time. And I know it's probably painful for you to talk about that experience, but can you tell us a little bit about what happened on your third trip to you and to the other people in the group that you crossed with?
So the third time, in the middle of June of 1980, I got to meet people from all over our country in our second trip because it was 45 of us. And then we met in the Capitol. We started building friendships and community. It was this excitement of meeting people from everywhere that were coming up north. Some of them would have stories of family members being killed, some of them fleeing because they were looking for them. So we all had that in common, why we were leaving. The third time is when the smugglers were stressing because we already had used their money in the first trip with them. So we were putting in a very nasty hotels and so many people in one place. The journey took about 7 days from El Salvador, about 2,500 miles. Confined in a bus, we start noticing the heat make us walk in Mexico side for miles and miles in the desert, try to avoid the federales in the Mexican side. We had a beautiful young girl, Claudia, who was 12, one of the three sisters in the story. She was blonde, skinny, tall, beautiful blue eyes. She didn't even look Salvadorian, but in parts of my country, there is people, they are very light skinned. So the smugglers would use her to sit her right in the front of the bus. So the federales would think that our bus was a tourist bus because she was white. So with 7 days of the journey, we get to the border town of Sonoita, Sonora, and next to the Organ Pipe National Park. So we were ordered by the smugglers to separate. Thank goodness they separated the women with the babies, with the children, and they sent them to Yuma, Arizona. But Claudia was only 12 years old, and her older sister, 14 and 16, they stayed with us in our group. And then we started our crossing. There was no wall at that time. It was a barbed wire, so it was really easy to cross. The smugglers told us, "You are going to be in an airplane within an hour, so take whatever you want." So that's why a lot of women had suitcases, high heels, their makeup on. They want to look beautiful to meet their husbands, their families. The three girls were overexcited to meet their mom. And I'm sorry because I say this story so many times and for so many years, but it never gets easier for me to realize that in that journey in 1980 in July, and within 5 days, 13 of my friends were gone because we were lost. The smugglers who we trust in El Salvador and pay hired two Mexican smugglers that didn't know the way to take us through the desert. And this is so scary because, the desert is beautiful, but it's so deceive. It will kill you because it is huge and everything looks just the same. So for us, walking in the wilderness, we were walking in circles for more than 40 miles within 5 days. That's when we were rescued. But the toughest thing that has been in my life is to realize that all those people's lives were taken so fast, especially the three sisters and the woman. She was 3 months pregnant. So, it is something that happens when you are obligated to be displaced from what you know, from your country. This is what forced migration looks like, because you have to leave in order to survive, but you do not know what is coming for you.
You described in your book that one of the men who was supposed to be leading you through the desert, who didn't know where he was going, he actually beat and raped and killed some of the women. Is that correct?
Yes, and that is one of the Salvadorians, smugglers.
Okay, and how did you survive that guy?
It's hard for me to say if it was a miracle, if it was not my time, if it was because I was chosen, because it's not right. All of them had the right to be alive and survive and not die in that horrific way they did. The way I survived, because I crawled myself when I heard everything that it was happening, I was still conscious. And I crawled myself because I couldn't stand anymore to a palo verde tree, not too far from him, but I don't think he was strong enough to chase me. One of the things is that because my nature, I develop relationship and friendships. And, I guess, since the first trip, this man felt that I was a good person and that I was a help to him gathering people together and calming them down when they used to get so mad at him because he wouldn't feed us right. So he would look after me. But at the moment when he went crazy and started doing those horrible, horrible things to my friends, he did say, "I'm not going to kill Dora because I don't know if she's alive, but she is a good person." So, maybe he chose not to hurt me. I don't know. But by the time we were found, he was found facing down under the tree around the women that he killed.
Oh my goodness. At that point, it wasn't too long after that the Border Patrol showed up and found you and rescued you. And there's a picture of you that made it into the New York Times, I recall, of him carrying you out. And from the story, it said that he was yelling at you, "Don't die on me, don't die on me." And they have that a very dramatic picture of you, which is in your book, but it was all very dramatic. But you had a lot of injuries and you went to the hospital. What kind of injuries did you have, and how long did it take you to recover from that experience?
So when we were rescued, we were flown to Ajo Hospital, to Ajo, Arizona, and we spent about a week in there. And we were dehydrated. My face was blistered everywhere. My throat, I couldn't swallow because of blisters in my throat. At one point, I woke up surrounded by nurses with this huge magnifying glass over me, and those nurses were crying. And they were telling me that my body was covered with shea cactus everywhere in my body. My hair was burned. So, this is what happened when you are under 110, 114 degrees for 5 days with no shade or no water.
After you recovered, were the men that killed these women and beat them, were they ever brought to justice? Were they ever arrested? What happened to them?
Carlos is the name of the Salvadorian smuggler that was found dead among the women. There was two more Salvadorian smugglers, one that it was caught in Yuma, Arizona, crossing the mother with the children, and then Elias, who was with us in a group, and the Mexican smuggler. So there were three of them. And that's the reason why we stay in Tucson, Arizona, because the government wanted to go after the smugglers. And as I said in my book, it was not because of all the death that had happened, all the horrific things that we went through. It was because they want to go after the smugglers. So we had to stay as a material witness in this town for a whole year. And every day we had to leave again and again and again to tell the story. It was terrible because I couldn't not get rid of my nightmares because when I was working on it, I had to tell the story again to all these people in the courtroom. They were given 5 years in prison, that's all, and they were free.
Okay, and in the meantime, were you given refugee status?
No, we never got refugee status. Just one of the group got asylum. One, because he knew some family members for the actual president in El Salvador at that time. But then none of us got refugee status. I became a resident 2 years later through marriage because I married my high school sweetheart, and I mentioned that story in my book. Through him, I was legalized. Years later, I became a US citizen.
Okay. It seems like your story is the ultimate story of why somebody should get refugee status. That's what refugees were set up for, people who were
Right.
fleeing for their lives. Do you have any idea why you were not given refugee status? Was there any reason given to you?
What is important to remember history and the story of what happened in El Salvador. El Salvador was a civil war. It wasn't a war with other countries, but the United States called our country an enemy, communist, and they say we're going to help the right government.
Okay, so they were supporting the government who was actually persecuting you.
At that moment, yes, they
Okay.
were supporting the government. Reagan came in and said, "We have to fight this war. They are right in our backyard and they're going to come to get us." So, with that fear that was created, this government start financing our war. It was a lot of money invested in this. It was $1.5 million every day sent to my country to kill my people. And the death squads, they were horrific, just didn't have any humanity in their souls, were trained in the United States to go kill our people. So because of all that, I truly, truly believe that it was not okay for us to get asylum. A million of us fled to different parts of the world, were displaced with the Civil War. You know, we just didn't get the status. We were called economical migrants. So they were saying these people is just leaving because they need a better job.
Okay, and you did get a green card when you got married here, and now you're a full-fledged citizen, right?
I have been for 35 years.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
And a lot of what you do now is to promote aid for people that are crossing the desert, just aid to migrants and the whole border situation. You're quite an advocate for migrants. You founded a nonprofit called Salvavision. Tell us what that is. Why did you found it, and what does it do?
So Salvavision, it was really my dream come through because 3 years since I became part of the sanctuary movement in 1982, when I felt a little safe to help my people coming from Guatemala and El Salvador, because those countries were in fire at that time in the early 80s. And then the sanctuary movement was in the beginning. So they were recruiting people across the country to help refugees and people fleeing the civil war. Because again, over and over, this government was denying asylum to these people and sending them back to be killed. Always, I want to be part of a movement that saves people's lives. I want to be part of something that creates humanity to educate people of what forced migration is, why people leave their countries in the horrific ways that many, many of us have to go through to safety. My daughter and I really worked very hard to put this together as a nonprofit. Every one of us is a volunteer. I have never been paid, which I don't want to. It's a labor of love. But we have been operating for almost 11 years now in Tucson, Arizona, and support thousands that have crossed our paths in different ways. Because we had a program in El Salvador with a scholarship for people who were deported with no opportunity to stay here. And then we have help in the border towns and near to us, which we have about five of them, and Nogales, Sonora, Sonoita, Sasabe, Sonora, Agua Prieta. So that's been part of my mission. And my mission is pretty much to humanize who we are. We are in a moment at this time, and it has been, it's really not that new, that people will call us different names. We are for people who does not know who Dora is. It's nothing but a migrant or a refugee or an illegal or an asylum seeker. But I want to remind people that before those titles, I am a person and each of us is a human being and we deserve to be treated just as a person. But it is right now so divided and it's very polarized that it is easier to call a group of people a name and then criminalize them, dehumanize them. And when you do dehumanize someone, it is easier to punish. It's easier to throw you in a detention center. It's easier to throw you back to where you came from seeking safety. So that's what I hope that I continue to do.
Tell us, if someone wants to get involved in helping this cause through your nonprofit, Salvavision, or other humanitarian organizations, there's quite a few of them, how do they go about volunteering and what would they be doing as volunteers?
So right now, our pretty much focus is in the town of Tucson, Arizona. We are in need of people to simple deliver a food box to a family. We are in need of mentors. We have so many children within our families that we support from everywhere, from Venezuela, from Guatemala, Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, Mexico. It's a beautiful quilt of love, you know? And so our volunteers are one-on-one with our families. If anyone would love to volunteer mentoring a child, you don't even have to be in person. You can do it via Zoom because all these kids are now in school and they are terrified. They are very scared that in the afternoon, the mom or dad is not going to be there to pick them up because they've been kidnapped by ICE. So this is very important thing to do because we can be present for these kids, helping them to learn to be kids, you know, and a lot of them are struggling with English. Besides the trauma of the journey, they are now here in fear. So how can a child learn with that environment? It is a very hard one. So there's quite a few things that people can do and help us.
Okay, and is there a website they should go to find out where they can contact someone to do this?
Yes, they can go to salvavision.org.
SalvaVision.org, salvavision.org.
And there's a form in there that you can fill it out and tell us what your interest is and how you can help. We're, of course, always in need of financial needs too, because we are paying for lots of rent. People have been taking their work permits away, and now they're stressing because they can't even work. Yes.
Okay, and if people want to get your book, which is quite fascinating, it tells your whole story from
Thank
El
you.
Salvador to today. How can people get your book?
They can go to my website, dorarodriguez.org.
Okay, it's a very easy to read book and a fascinating story, so.
Thank you. That's what was my purpose. Because I could easily write a book of 500 pages, but I thought, I don't want to put my reader to sleep. Okay, what do you do with this tragedy, with this little girl who grew up to go through this ordeal that didn't have any idea, but and then it became an outspoken and a voice for so many that their voices are being shut. So that's what my purpose was.
Okay, well, I think that you met that purpose. Right now, though, I think that we are out of time.
Yeah, well, we have come to the end of our show. And thank you, Dora Rodriguez, for joining us today and sharing your story. Thank you so much. Through Dora's public speaking and advocacy work, her focus is to educate communities about the harsh realities migrants face in the desert and to inspire transformative changes to the immigration injustices plaguing our border towns. We're so grateful to your courage and your voice. This show was a real gift to us and our listeners. And thanks to all of you out there listening today. This is Aspen Green with Kathy Harris, bringing you Broad Perspectives Radio. And you can hear more of our shows on our podcast page at kxci.org. For now, stay tuned, because next up we have Boom Goddess Radio with Jennifer Davis Page. Enjoy your Sunday, and we'll see you next week.
Wonderful.